TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Restoring the forest, the Indian way. Even though the so far most deadly fire of Northern California is over 100 miles away from me, it fills the air with acrid smoke that has obscured the sun for days. The town of Paradise went up in flames. It's a little over 20 years ago that I recorded the documentary that you will now hear again. My visit to Mountain Grove, Oregon, opened up a part of Native American history and culture and forest practice. It gave me hope that we could undo and heal the damage that Western European settlement and industrial forest practice had done to the peoples and the lands of what is now California. In Washington, D.C., Trump is sending out tweets that the fires are due to poor forest management, and he threatens to cut federal aid, implying that everything would be okay if there was more logging and mining and drilling going on, all practices that accelerated the current state of warming and climate chaos. Trump has that power since nearly 60% of California forests are under federal management and another two-thirds under private control. When Spanish conquistadors rode up the West Coast, they were astonished to see that they entered forests that looked like parks with widely spaced trees. Church and military records show that in the early 19th century, California's forests were carefully tended. The catastrophic wildfires of today were extremely rare. California natives used controlled fires to create these parks. But the use of fire was outlawed by the settlers from 1850 on. There's no talk about bringing back controlled burns, but how complex, interwoven with intimate knowledge of the web of life that practice is, was beginning to dawn on me when I set out to Mountain Grove for a three-day visit with Dennis Martinez. And here is the archival program I produced after the visit. The forest at the Mountain Grove Center near Glendale, Oregon, was clear-cut in the 1930s and 40s. It has come back thick, young, and dark with invasive trees. When Indians cared for the land, the indigenous oaks, old-growth incense cedars, and chinkapins were spaced widely like a park. Plants thrived on the sunlit forest floor, and animals found shelter and food. Dennis Martinez knows about Indian forest practice, and we visited him when he was beginning the restoration of the 400-acre Mountain Grove Forest. Dennis Martinez is of Oodham and Chicano heritage, and he helps traditional communities with the restoration of ancestral lands. He is a well-loved and popular writer and lecturer on cultural survival, and he works in the forests of the Klamath Mountains of southwestern Oregon as a seed collector, vegetation surveyor, restoration tree thinner, and ethnobotanist. Describe to us where we're sitting here.
We're sitting below a very large Douglas fir tree by a brush pile it's a wildlife pile. All the birds come by here and the chipmunks. And the hogan that we live in is just down there by the creek. And between here and there and all around us, you're hearing jays in the background. These are all our friends and family members. We raise them sometimes. We talk to them. We feed them. They come into our house. We have open door policy. Not unusual to have 5 juncos, 6 chipmunks, 2 jays, a gopher snake, and 4 alligator lizards, northern and southern, in our hogan at one time. But these are relatives, right? This is the relationship we're talking about here. So we have a personal relationship. Same with the trees here.
Can you talk about how you are restoring the forest?
The forest here at Mountain Grove, which is about 420 acres, is around 3/4 trees and 1/4 meadows. And is pretty, what they call pretty thick. You know, it's a lot of trees per acre. 1,000, 1,500 in places, 2,000 small trees, small stems per acre. Historically, there were probably 25 to 50 trees max. They're all mostly large, old growth, pine, and fir, and oaks, and chinkapin. And mostly we've had invasion by Douglas fir and Grand fir, such that we are getting a very shady, what they call stem exclusion stage of the forest now. And so we've been doing some thinning to try to get some sunlight back in and then try to get fire back in. Without the fire, lots of species go away. A lot of plants and animals simply disappear because they don't have any food source, or they don't get pollinators, or they can't bloom in the shade. And so we see all over the legacy of industrial forestry, which was the clear cut. This was clear cut in the 30s and 40s. The trees are maybe 70 some years old now. Coming up all these little stems, and they get crowded. Whereas the Indian people that used to live here burned on a regular basis. And so they were separated, more like a park. 25 trees to an acre is not many trees. Lots of space in between the trees for things to grow and for good wildlife habitat. So we're trying to reverse that degradation here and restore some of that historical type of forest structure and composition that used to be here, and try to get our birds back. We don't have too many birds here because we have shady conditions. And the same with the deer and the elk. We don't have too much coming through. So we are trying to address those problems.
What traces do you find of the Indians who lived here?
The Indian people in Western Oregon were badly impacted by genocide at the time of the Gold Rush. Indians were hunted down in these hills. they were hunted down for bounties, same in California. $1 for a man's scalp, 50 cents for a woman, 25 cents for a child. And so that they were virtually wiped out. And then the women, the few surviving women, became slaves to the white people. And they produced offspring. Some were recognized, some weren't. And those people constitute many of the tribes in Western Oregon who have lost most of their culture. And there are individuals that retain, such as family knowledge and of ceremonies and a little language sometimes. And these families are scattered here and there, but for the most part, the Indian people in Western Oregon have had really a great amount of cultural fragmentation, probably more than most places in the United States.
Do you get a sense, walking through the woods here, what roots and berries may have been nourishing the Indians who lived in this valley?
When Indian women burned this forest, and there are a lot of oak trees that you may have seen when you came in. We're trying to revive those oaks and get them to regenerate. The same with the pine that's going away. It's like the state tree of Oregon is Douglas fir, right? Because it's a lumber tree. Well, the Indian women favored sugar pine here because the seeds were large and edible. And there was more pine in general because there was a fire frequency that was pretty significant. And oaks were also dependent on that fire to maintain healthy stands, okay, and good acorn production, recycled nutrients, all that. And what we're trying to do, at least I'm trying to do, is to use that as a reference ecosystem for how to restore land in southwestern Oregon. Because when those Indian women burned some places every year, they had a wide variety of very healthy plants. They had basket plants with straight shoots they could make, that you can't even find now, hazelnut and so on. And they had many medicine plants and many plants that constitute good quality wildlife habitat, which meant that the wildlife was incredible, as every early document attests. Much of this had to do with the coevolution of human beings with fire in this ecosystem and animals and plants. They co-evolved together, the individual humans, the culture, the tribes here, the plants and the animals came up together far longer period of time than anthropologists concede. We think tens of thousands of years, they say 10,000 years max. Perhaps they have always been here. This was a very inhabited place. This was a world that was full of people and trade. It was international. And of course, it serves the interests of Western society to minimize the length of time and the impact Indian people had in this land. Because if they'd only been here a short while before the Europeans came, then they did what Europeans did couldn't have been all that bad. And of course, if the Indians had caused the extinction of the megafauna at the end of the last ice age and so forth and so on, then all the things Europeans have done are really that bad. After all, this is the way human beings are, right? Culture doesn't matter. How many textbooks you read? Man is greedy, man is bad, man does these terrible things to the natural world. This isn't necessarily true because there is such a thing as cultural differences. And so if we recognize that, then we have to recognize those Indian women I was talking about that used to set these very humble fires here where we're standing and sitting, and that benefited the land and in fact made the land the way it was. That fire set by the Indian women determined how that land looked here and how it produced. And of course the main rationale for genocide was that Indians were not doing anything to make the land productive, right? So therefore, it was there for the taking. The Indians were savages, very primitive. Therefore, the Europeans that had advanced culture and agriculture were going to take and raise the level of potential of this land to its proper place that God had foreordained to have the Europeans do. And that's why they did what they did, because that was in God's intention, of course, that they make this land produce, right? The truth is, this land, the species here, the plants that I survey here, the animals that I know should be here that are not here, have diminished under European management. Opposite. The land is less productive than it was. It's very productivity that produced all the big timber that built San Francisco and lots of other places and was shipped to China. The land that was kept open by the fires in the Great Plains that produced the corn and the wheat that fed the world, okay? Everything that enhanced the making of what they call North American civilization was a direct result of Indian management of the land. To deny that is to say the same thing that Europeans said when they set foot, the Indians are not doing anything, just laying around beating drums, you see? And then they made a lot of stories up about the women having to do all the be the beasts of burden and so forth and so on. All these are absolute fairy tales. The idea that pioneers had to hew down these great forests is false because Indians had already kept the land open from the eastern seaboard to Oregon. They moved in where the Indians already lived. If the old people were to come back here now and look at this landscape, they would say that no one is taking care of this place. It is uncared for, it's looking junky, it's looking wild. We took care of it. And all the places that were important to the people, that were etched in their own minds when they were growing up, they knew the boundaries by heart. All those places, like the neighborhood you grow up in at home, in a city, are eradicated. Whether you clear-cut lock or you do nothing, in the end, it's a different place, unless it's restored. While we all condemn rightly the industrial ecocide that's occurring and the clear cuts, to say that nature on her own, after such a devastating onslaught by industrial civilization, will somehow pull us out on her own is pretty far-fetched. We have got to take responsibility. Those of us who love the land are going to have to take that responsibility. So it cannot just say, let's not do anything. Nature will take care of herself, because by the time she finishes taking care of herself, which she will do just fine in a few thousand years, human beings, our children's legacy, and many, many species that we now love and know about will be gone. So to take responsibility now is extremely critical. With Indian people, it's a matter of collective and individual responsibility in ceremonies to make up for what was used up by people, to set the world right spiritually, get the house of the forest in order. We live on animals, we live on plants. Are you taking responsibility for that? Are you contributing to the renewal on a yearly basis of the earth. See, when Indian people don't do that, what is going to happen? These ceremonies are critical, and so is the practical work of caregiving. And one thing that a lot of young Indian people now forget, they go to Lakota Sweat Lodge or whatever, is that in that environment on the plains, it wasn't just a Sundance that was important. It was what people did to take care of their place and each other that was important 365 days a year. And so sometimes we turn our Indian ways into a religion once a year for 4 days or once a week in Sweat Lodge, Lakota style. But in fact, we need to learn to be caregivers 365 days a year and perform our ceremonies. And until we're able to do that, we cannot call ourselves Indian culture, because Indian culture is about caring for the people and the land. And when that's lost, you can have all the drums in the world, the songs, the feathers, and even the language, and you've lost the biggest part of what it is to be an Indian. Putting culture and history back into nature, yeah, not taking it out. The scientists pretend that it's just all quite natural without humans, but humans had a big impact on this land. You can restore land where humans have co-evolved with plants and animals without recognizing the contribution of humans. Any species, whether human or non-human, that's a key player in ecosystems has got to be acknowledged as a key player. You know, this is only trying to get the full story of what we need to restore. And if part of what we need to restore was Indian women burning every 2 years in a certain situation, then we need to restore that, because the plants have a genetic memory that responds to that frequency of fire and intensity that they used to set those fires at. They hit that threshold, those plants have a genetic memory that's activated, and they come back. And if you ignore that because you say people are not part of this ecosystem and Indians hadn't made any impact because they were primitive savages, that kind of thinking, you destroy the science you have, you're using to restore the land. You're not doing good science then. Science, in fact, can't really function very well globally without the traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples who know the plants because they use them, or they know the animals because they use them, to have a relationship with them. So science needs the input of those elders that have knowledge. If you go out there and thin trees, you don't know exactly what's going to come up. Now, it's one thing to have an idea based on an old system, a reference ecosystem, that the Indian people had taken care of, on the structure and the composition of the forest and the processes like fire that were there, right? It's quite another thing to go down to a very site-specific case and to be able to predict with any assurance what's going to happen when you manipulate vegetation, or when you return fire to the system, because we don't have the same plants around anymore. So we have to be very careful and start small scale and do a lot of small experimental work before we can extrapolate from that on a larger scale. And that's very important. We don't claim to know that much. In other words, we're often criticized by people that say, how do you know how to restore land? Isn't this rather arrogant? And in a sense it is, if you try to do more than you're capable of doing. But we always move extremely slowly on restoring land because we're learning as we go. The Forest Service and BLM call this adaptive management. In other words, it's a feedback loop. Now, we think we're going to go someplace. We get the structure right. We thin the trees. We get the fire back in. And then we have wall-to-wall poison oak or cheatgrass or bracken fern, right? So then we need to find the seeds to bring back after the fire. So you can't just thin, nor can you just thin and burn, but you need to thin, burn, and reseed over time, repeatedly, before you get the take. It sometimes takes 10 years, 20 years to affect a conversion, even in a small place. So this is a very long-term situation we're talking about. We assume that this land has always looked like it looks now. When we assume that, we write off tens of thousands of years of Indian history in this country. I have enough respect for the culture of a people who have been here as long as indigenous peoples have been in this continent to want to emulate what they learned over thousands of years. We do not have the luxury of time in science to reinvent the wheel over and over. We don't know what we're doing. It's better to go back to the past, to find the future through the past, as a beginning point, even though we know it's going to change and get modified as we actually do our work, than to attempt to project from secondary succession now in this chaos in which we don't fully understand. And by doing so, we leave out all the plants and animals that used to be here that still have a fighting chance to come back through our efforts. So it is a matter of respect in the end. Respect for life, respect for history, respect for culture. It's putting history and culture back into nature.
That is Dennis Martinez, recorded in Southern Oregon, where he was working on forest restoration. We spent 3 days with him at Mountain Grove and accompanied him to see firsthand what had been done. We drove to the western edge of the forest, not far from Interstate 5.
We didn't want to change the light too rapidly. You have underground relationships with the mycorrhizal fungi and on the shrubs and the trees, and they're all linked together underground. And you have light conditions. If you change too fast, you get sun scald, you get wind throw. You sever those relationships, okay? That's what clear cuts do. That's why clear cuts are bad. So what we're trying to do is ease into it so the plants and the animals can adjust slowly to the change. So it's a light hand. You could not have walked through here without bumping into a tree anywhere in this whole place. And that meant that all the little pines and all the little oaks, just a matter of time before they were going to die. And look, you see the branches coming out on the sides, okay? This is all this year since we did the thinning. Now we have a beginning of a healthy tree.
You mean even the large ones will grow side branches?
The large and the small oaks, when they're released from shade, will put out the side branches on the trunk or bole. And then the pink irrigation flagging that you see scattered around are those plants and plant communities we did not want Juan Mendoza's crew to pile slash on. So I went through the whole 28 acres and picked out all the plants that needed to be restored or preserved or conserved, right? And then every place there's not flagged, we put the slash. As long as it's not directly under a tree like a jackpot, and it's out in the open, so if it does catch on fire, it doesn't go into a canopy. We had to reduce what we call fuel ladders and jackpots, which we had up the yin-yang. That's little trees going into bigger trees that go into still bigger trees. So if you have a ground fire and it's hot enough, 2 and 3 foot flame lengths, they go up the trunk, get into the foliage, go up the trunk, get into the limbs, and finally crown out at the top. This is what we're trying to reduce. If we had a ground fire start from the likely ignition source, which is the road or power lines, the wind blows from that direction, or residences over here, we could buy time through the thinning to get the fire department over here and get our own fire department going so that we could control it before it became a major catastrophic wildfire. We want to put native grasses here that are bunch grasses, so you have discontinuous ground fuel. And then we're going to allow patches of brush to be, but we want to reduce the majority, okay, of the fuel. So we still have the wildlife habitat, we have the regeneration of oaks and pines favored, and we have a fuel break of a kind, okay.
We returned and sat in front of Dennis Hogan. The windows were propped open so birds and squirrels were able to get inside to find shelter. A jay flew out of the incense cedar and sat on Dennis' shoulder for a while and looked curiously at my microphone.
How does one person find such special and hidden knowledge? I mean, you can't just pick up a book and learn what you learned.
Any way you can. And books are part of it, and oral teaching is part of it, and your own observations are part of it. I mean, we need all the help we can get. We don't have a lot of knowledge, you know, left in a lot of areas, and so we use everything: science, Western science, traditional knowledge, and our own eyes, ears, and hearts. You know, I mean, all of it's important. The forest itself will tell you to extent what was there. the old growth stumps that they cut down, right? The spacing of those stumps. The old records of surveys and biological expeditions of various kinds, botanical people that came and explored, military records, virtually any way, whatever was written down or drawn or photographed about the land and the changes it's been through is important. You don't ever achieve, of course, anything even close to what it once was, because that's impossible. Once we've lost a system that's utterly unique, it's gone forever. But if we get the important parts of it back, the important parts of the structure, the function, and the processes, we know enough to know. Right now, we have enough knowledge to know that if we get certain key parts back, the system will run on its own. And that's all we're trying to do. We don't think in terms of 5 and 10 years. We think in terms of hundreds of years. 400 years, 500 years. What keeps us going is the knowledge that we have an opportunity to save as much as we can in this generation. Kind of like Noah's Ark, that we need to have places where people in future generations, because it is, as Corbin Harney says, going to get worse before it gets better. That in future generations, we have a place to go back and look to where these places still exist in a good way, where people are involved in the ecosystems, where the plants and animals have a refuge, like Noah's Ark, you know, to hang out in, and where there are still human beings that have kindness and goodness, you know, spirit. Because without that model, it's like the kid on the street in East Oakland, you know. If he has never experienced any kindness from a human being, there's no going back. There's nothing to go back to. The kids that come back from the street and the drugs and the gangs have had something in their early life that was good. And if we get to the point where there's no good left, no matter how much bad there is, then there's no models, no role models, humans or ecological. And that's why we do this.
Dennis Martinez, recorded inside a forest in southern Oregon. Dennis Martinez is of Oodham Chicano heritage, and he often visits traditional communities to help with the restoration of ancestral lands. He has worked as a seed collector, vegetation surveyor, restoration tree thinner, and ethnobotanist. This was a rebroadcast of a 1996 documentary on Indigenous forest practice, Restoring the Forest the Indian Way. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.